Dear listeners, this episode is a little different and quite special. I'm helping the Bangalore International Centre launch the BIC Talks podcast and will be hosting the first several episodes. Here's episode 1, where we talk to Kiran Mazumdar-Shaw about some of the things that India can do to make the most out of the nationwide lockdown to contain the threat of the COVID-19 pandemic. Thanks for tuning in and subscribe to the BIC Talks podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. Here on the Pragati podcast, we will continue to share new episodes on COVID-19 and other vital issues. All our recordings for the coming months will be done remotely with guests recording from across the world. I apologize in advance for the reduction in audio quality. Welcome to the Pragati podcast, a weekly talk show on public policy, economics, and international relations. We take a step back from noisy political debates and dive into rich conversations on India and the world. I am your host, Pavan Srinath. We'll start this episode's conversation after a short break. Hi, and welcome to the first episode of BIC Talks. I'm Pavan Srinath, and I'm delighted to be chatting with Dr. Kiran Mazumdar-Shaw, the chairperson of Biocon and a pioneering biotech and healthcare specialist in India. We're also joined by Ravi Chander, the honorary director of the Bangalore International Centre. We are recording this on day one of a 21-day nationwide lockdown in response to the COVID-19 pandemic that is sweeping across the world.
This is Ravi here, Kiran. Thank you so much for doing the first episode of the new podcast, BIC Talks, that the Bangalore International Centre has set up. Kiran, I'd like to get this started. As Pawan mentioned, we are on day one of the 21-day lockdown. We feel it is necessary and it's the right thing to do. Can you help us understand how this 21-day lockdown will help, Kiran?
Thanks, Ravi, for having me kick off this very important platform for BIC. And I'm sure it's going to be a great success in this brave new world that we are entering into. Let me explain to you the scientific rationale behind this 21-day lockdown. As you know, COVID-19 has been declared a pandemic. You are actually seeing the spread of this disease and the exponential growth of this disease in many, many countries at a rate which they were not prepared for. And it is very evident that you have to do something very urgently to stem the spread of the disease. Now, what happens is that when anything like this happens, the spread of the disease is by contact. You know, as soon as you have a people-to-people contact, you start spreading the disease. So the lockdown is a way to prevent this person-to-person contact. So basically, you're trying to segregate people and prevent them from spreading this particular virus. And the hope is that in a period of 21 days, which is really the time in which the virus basically incubates, infects, grows, and starts infecting more people, you expect that the people who are segregated, you will have people who are already infected or people who are not infected. And you're hoping that the people who are infected will actually come out of this disease and get fully recovered and actually start building what we refer to as social immunity. The moment after this 21 days is over, you will start creating a population with negative and with recovered patients. That is the hope. The hope is that by segregating the patients, you have a large number of people who are negative and you have a large number of people who have recovered, because the 21 days is a time in which people who have got the disease should have recovered. So that is the kind of rationale and the thinking behind the 21 days. I think it's a very sensible way of looking at the spread. So after the 21 days are over, you then believe that because people have recovered and people are negative, that the spread will be contained and that basically you will start developing a large social or what they call herd immunity, which then starts preventing the spread of this disease like the way it is happening today. I hope that is a simple explanation.
Thank you so much, Kiran. What we have seen world over is very, very different responses from various countries. Some who have done amazingly well in testing, some who have done amazingly well in lockdown, and some who have had a very laissez-faire approach as well. So in that sense, with this lockdown being an important step in combating this pandemic, do you think for India, the greatest challenges still lie ahead of us when it comes to this pandemic? And what would they be?
You know, Pawan, it all depends on what we do in this 21-day period. You mentioned testing, and I really believe we need to use these 21 days to significantly and exponentially ramp up testing. So, for instance, if we start ramping up testing first in, say, the quarantined population, people who have already been quarantined, people who are actually working in hospitals as hospital workers, I think we need to also test them. These are the first group of people. Then we basically start testing people that the quarantine people have been in contact with, okay, potentially in contact with. And then you start testing people in communities. For instance, why can't we test employees who are actually serving in the essential services? You know, whether it is the Swiggy guy who's delivering food, whether it is the people who are working in essential industries, whether it is people who are just carrying out essential services, I think all these people need to be tested. Once you start developing data and generate data in a large database, you can actually very quickly start doing a lot of analytics to see where we are with the disease. Right now, we are shooting in the dark because we really have very little data to go by. You just have data on, say, about 600 positive patients. And this particular small database that we have is not bad. It's quite reassuring that you have only about 10 or 11 deaths, that you have very few people in ICU, quite a large number have recovered, and most of the others are in a recovering phase. So that is certainly very promising, but that's not enough data and that's not enough to rely on to give us comfort. What we need to do is after 21 days, we should be in a state of comfort and confidence with which we can then start lifting the curfew in a stepwise way. Obviously, we should not rush and just remove the entire curfew, but at least if you've got reliable data that is reassuring and promising, it puts you into this zone of comfort that we have a large number of people who have recovered. And more than anything else, if you can prove that the severity of COVID-19 in India is quite low, then you have the comfort with which to deal with the disease. Then you know that you have the resources and the medical infrastructure to cope with the disease, because you then have to only cope with a small percentage of severely affected patients, which happens in any flu. But till we get to that point, we really are not confident.
Kiran, thank you so much for providing this clarity, because some of the global conversations, sometimes it's pitted as more testing versus things like social distancing and lockdowns. And what you have underlined very clearly is that it's an effective combination of the two of them that work well. And even within testing, thank you so much for clarifying how it's almost like concentric rings of testing, where we expand from one ring to the next on one side of those who might be at risk of this disease. And on the other side, people who are running our essential services, keeping food and resources and other things flowing to all citizens. Both of these are critical to help all of us get through this. But in order to do this, could you tell us about the kind of testing capacity and the access to testing kits that is there in India right now? Are we in a position now to test at the pace that is necessary?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Pawan. And let me answer that by saying that initially, of course, there was a sort of a panic-like situation saying, how do we expand testing? How do we ramp up testing? And of course, all the private labs came saying, hey, we can do it, we can do it. And, you know, I was tasked with trying to sort of bring all this together with the government. So what we found was that initially we had a sort of taken a view that, okay, let's go with US FDA and European FDA approved kits. Okay, that was the simplest logical thing to do. And so we had Thermo Fisher kits and the Roche kits, which were approved by the US, you know, at an accelerated pace. And US was using it. So if US is using it, we can safely use it, was the logic. Then we realized that even to get these Thermo Fisher kits and the Roche kits, we would be in a queue. And that we would not get these kits before 3 or 4 weeks. We can't wait so long. In the meantime, we in the biotech field realized that, by the way, this is not rocket science. I mean, all that you need to do is you need to get a positive controlled RNA. By the way, this virus is an RNA-based virus. And the sequence is known. So you need to get the positive controlled RNA sequence. And then what you do is you take a swab of an infected or even a not infected person. You collect the virus from this swab and you amplify it using what they call as polymerase chain reaction or PCR. Once you amplify it, you can then compare it to this positive control and see whether it is positive or negative. Now, it is about how closely it is comparable to that control. Okay, that's the way it goes in biotech. And if it is positive, you do a further confirmatory test by taking the actual human COVID-19 virus that you would have got from some patients. And you use that as a further positive control to make sure that it is comparable to that. So that's how it works. And in a short turnaround time of a few hours, you can do this. And it's no rocket science. So what we found is that there were already a few indigenous labs who had actually developed their own indigenous kits based on the same thinking. And one of them was my lab in Pune. The other one was Kosara in Vadodara, who's all actually a joint venture with a US company. And this kit actually has been approved in the US by the US FDA for emergency testing. And since they've been already shipping a large number of these kits from Seattle to Korea and Italy and many of the affected places, we felt that this was an easy to scale up kit because they can also manufacture it in India. Now, of course, they were awaiting manufacturing license in India. So that's what we tried to accelerate and fast track. But in the meantime, my lab kits from Pune are ready to go. That was good news because then the private labs can actually start with these indigenous kits. And they are in a position to actually produce, I think, something like 10,000 kits a week to begin with. But they think they can even ramp that up to 100,000 kits. So I think it gives us a feeling that, yes, we do have at least a source of kits to start with. And, you know, it will keep adding. So hopefully in a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, we'll have a testing capacity for millions. So that's really the way we're looking at it. And so to answer your question, I think, yes, we can ramp up.
Thank you so much for clarifying that, because there's been a lot of uncertainty and also a little bit of fear about whether we can ramp this up, whether there are all kinds of barriers to this. So currently, instead of relying on FDA approval or someone else within India, is the National Institute of Virology the one who is sort of testing and approving these kits that are being made by the private sector and by various players?
Yeah, so I think the National Institute of Virology is evaluating these kits and testing it against the positive controls, which are really the human controls available with them. And based on that, after the NIV evaluates all these indigenous kits, they are giving their approval, based on which the CDSCO, that is the drugs controller, is then giving the final approval.
Thank you, Kiran. This is about testing, and then the faster we get testing out, then we can have various kinds of measures against anyone who tests positive, whether they're symptomatic, whether they have an extreme condition, or whether they have a mild version of the COVID-19 infection. And once we get through this and once we build the herd immunity, do you still think there is a necessity for a vaccine or for some drug as a cure in the future? Or do we also need drugs right now to help some of the people who are already suffering from COVID-19? Could you tell us about that development process a little bit?
Before I answer those questions, I must also tell you that in addition to the present PCR test that I talked about, there is also a need for serological tests. It means you take blood samples, the blood serum, and you should actually check. There is an antibody test. Okay? So the antibody test actually tells you whether you're negative, whether you are recovering, or whether you have recovered. So the PCR test basically tells you whether you have the virus or not. But this antibody test actually tells you whether you are negative, that means you have not got the disease, whether you are recovering with the disease, or whether you have recovered from the disease. These are very important data points to have. And that is also another set of tests that are being developed, and we need to use that very quickly. So in addition to the PCR tests, we need to also do the serological antibody tests. So I just wanted to put that into perspective. So that will give you even more information about giving you the comfort to know about the state of our herd immunity that I talked about.
Thank you, Kiran.
Now coming to the treatments. A vaccine is absolutely essential because if you look at any flu, it needs a flu vaccine to protect yourself in the future. There are many vaccines available for each of the kind of flus, and we definitely need a vaccine against this flu because it is such a dangerous and nasty kind of a virus. So I think we definitely need a vaccine against this. But the truth is that the vaccine will take at least a year before you can actually offer it to patients around the world, because it has to go through a regulatory pathway, which includes clinical trials in a step-up way. So you start with safety trials, which is the phase one trial. Normally that's done in healthy volunteers. And of course, all these trials have to be done in healthy volunteers, but you need time to see whether these people are picking up the virus or not. So that's why it takes so much time. So you need to basically give these vaccines, measure their antibody responses, and so on and so forth. So it takes a long time. So you have to make sure that the first safety trials in phase one are done. Then you have an efficacy trial where you actually want to make sure that the vaccine is actually doing what it's supposed to do. You're giving a virus and you want to see that the antibody is also responding at a certain rate. And then you finally do a phase three trial in a much larger population. And by the way, as you're doing this, you will also do animal testing where you're actually infecting animals with the virus and seeing how they are recovering. So all this work is being done. By the time you finish all these trials, it will take at least 1 year. So the only thing you can say is that the people who are participating in the trial, if indeed the vaccine works, they will be benefited from being a part of that trial. But the others will have to wait. And by the way, there are many companies developing vaccines. So it won't be just one vaccine, but there'll be multiple companies developing a COVID-19 vaccine. But nothing is going to be available before a year. The minimum period I can think of is a year. So if the trial started just now, I don't think you're going to get a vaccine ready till next April. So that's the amount of time we will have to wait for a vaccine to feel absolutely safe. But until then, you really need to look at treatment options. So right now, there are multiple drugs that are being trialed to see if they are really working and are they effective against the virus. One of the other therapies that is also being tried is what they call as the convalescent plasma therapy, which means that what they do is that from a recovered patient, they take the blood plasma, they expand it and put it into people who are infected or who are really suffering from COVID-19. And in many of these cases, the antibodies that the recovered patients have, because they fought the disease with that antibody, is helping the patients to fight this disease. So that's quite an interesting therapy. And that is something I think we also should be trying, because it has worked quite effectively in some of the patients. But of course, it's not an easy therapy to give to everyone. So if you have a small load of patients, you can certainly try this out.
Kiran, you mentioned about the drugs and the treatment. One has also been reading about the concern about PPE, the personal protection equipment for the healthcare workers and in the hospital. How is India faring in the availability of this PPP?
I think there's a huge challenge, I would say, Ravi, because I think this is absolutely essential for safe working conditions for health workers who are treating these infected patients. It's very, very urgently required to make sure that we have this PPE available for our use in large numbers. Although some of the companies are capable of making such a protective equipment, I think we need it at a much higher scale. So I think I would call upon the likes of, you know, Mukesh Ambani and many others who can actually help to actually focus on making this available, because this is a really huge need and it will go beyond just COVID-19 epidemic. So I think we really need to gear up in terms of how we use protective gearing in this country, because as you know, when you go to most of our hospitals, we really use it in a very, very frugal manner. We don't use it all the time, which we should be using, not just because of COVID-19, but for any other diseases, because the hospitals are full of diseases. And I think every health worker must be protected at all times. So I think there's a huge industry that needs to produce this at massive scale.
Kiran, in this time of lockdown, is this also a time where India needs to sort of ramp up some of its special care facilities, hospital facilities, in the event that we are not able to flatten the curve quickly enough, in the event that some of these cases continue to rise exponentially, like what we see in Italy, start overwhelming the system? We are hearing stories where people are outfitting cruise ships, taking stadiums and repurposing them in various ways. What do you think India can do in these few weeks when it comes to special hospital infrastructure and perhaps ICU units and things like ventilators? And what can we do while most of Indians are trying to stay at home and practice social distancing?
Yeah, that's a very important point. I think certainly we need to be in a state of preparedness for any eventuality. And I think this is something which definitely the government and everyone is absolutely looking at, to see how do we rapidly expand capacity of hospital beds, ICU beds, and all the things that go with it, like the ventilators and what have you. Just to share with you what's happening, one of the thinking is that now that the tourism industry and basically just there's a lockdown and no people are coming, I think hotels are almost shut. And we are saying, why don't we convert these hotels into quarantine zones or quarantine units? And it should also house either asymptomatic or people with mild symptoms who are positive. I think this can be a sort of an approach where you start with people who are anyway quarantined because they have traveled from abroad. They are not even being tested. These are all asymptomatic travelers who have been just put into quarantine centers and they're complaining, saying the conditions are not good. In fact, using the hotels for such people is a good idea. So they can all be quarantined there. But then once you test them, you will find there will be positive people who may not show symptoms or mild symptoms, and they also can be kept in these hotels under nursing supervision. And once they develop slightly worse symptoms, then you can shift them to the hospital. So that staging process is one of the things that is being thought through. The second thing is, obviously, within a hospital, if the symptoms are really bad, you obviously take them to the ICU. And we're also looking at getting private sector hospitals to dedicate some of their hospitals as COVID hospitals. You might have just seen that Reliance just announced that they have created such a COVID hospital in Mumbai. There's another hospital called Nayati in Mathura that has also created a COVID hospital near Delhi. In Bangalore, I think NH and Manipal and Apollo is also looking at creating a large number of COVID hospitals. And the other hospitals are already trying to create these dedicated COVID hospitals. And I think between them, if you look at it across the country, you will probably have an additional maybe 5,000 to 10,000 hospital beds, which are isolated for COVID patients, which I think is a good thing to do. Now, what we also realize is that there is likely to be a shortage of ventilators if we have to learn by what's happened in Italy. And for that reason alone, we've started looking at how do we build up the inventory of ventilators in the country. There was a panic because we realized that we were woefully short of ventilators across the country. For instance, in Karnataka alone, we had less than 1,000 ventilators, which was really a bad situation to be in. And at that time, we then remembered that there was a company in Mysuru called Scanray, which actually was making ventilators. So we actually approached them and we found, not to our surprise, that they were actually making ventilators and shipping it off to Italy and other countries. So we told them, listen, we need to procure ventilators from you and you better now start making ventilators for India. And he said, gladly, but I need financial backing because I don't have the financial muscle to ramp up the way you want me to. So we actually put our heads together. Infosys Foundation immediately said, yes, we can help with financing them. So we've come up with a model. Immediately, we've given them an order of 1,000 units. And they've already told us that they will divert some of the stock that they had made for exports. By the end of the month, we should be getting about close to 200 units. And then they feel that by the end of April, they will start giving us the 1,000 we definitely get. They also have a way of ramping up beyond that. Mahindra has made a statement saying that they want to start making ventilators. Reliance said they will start making ventilators. But all that will take time. So we've actually encouraged Mahindra's to see if they can join hands with ScanRate to see if they can make it even faster. So I think lots of good work is going on in that direction. But at least we have some hope that we've got access to some ventilators in the country. Also, I know that there are some startups who have done some very clever engineering to be able to double up capacity by creating a one ventilator serving two patients kind of technology. So lots of things are happening and I'm just hoping that we don't even need to use them finally, but we must gear up. But on that subject, Pawan, I also want to say public health is something which we really need to look at in a much more serious way. Because really our public health system is very weak. And I think this is actually showing up in the whole world. Every country today will now look at communicable diseases far more seriously than they have done in the past. This was considered a neglected diseases. You know, communicable diseases are like neglected. No, they don't need to worry about it because they won't get it. That was the feeling. So everybody invested in non-communicable disease research, whether it is cancer, diabetes, autoimmune diseases, neurological diseases, there were a lot of money going into that. But hardly anything going into communicable diseases. Why? Because they felt the developing world is where it all happens. We are safe. This is a wake-up call for the world. It has shown the developed countries that they are not safe. And unless they invest in research of communicable diseases and infectious diseases, they are going to be also at high risk. In fact, it will be very interesting for you to see. This is a hypothesis. We need more data. But if you look at the global data that is being shared today, you will see that the worst affected are the most affluent countries. And numbers coming out of the developing world are much, much lower. So the question is, do we have innate immunity? Because we've been fighting these diseases all the time. That is something to be looked into and researched. So are we in a position to fight COVID-19 better than the very sterile environments of the West? You know, those are questions we need to ask.
Thank you, Kiran. This is so reassuring to know that in so many sectors and so many spaces, there is work that is happening on a warlike footing. And even in times of wars, the normal means of production are halted and redirected towards a war effort, right? And here it's a far more noble cause where we are redirecting a lot of private and public efforts towards combating this global pandemic, both at home and perhaps even abroad. So in this, with India's biotech sector coming from the early days of Biocon to where we are in 2020, where beyond Biocon, we have this thriving biotech sector in Bangalore and elsewhere in the country. What else do you think are the opportunities for contributing to this and perhaps some challenges that we need to overcome while we are doing this?
So let me use a slightly different adjective to thriving.
Okay.
Okay. The biotech sector is certainly mushrooming, but it is struggling. I believe that this is a time to now relook at what we have not done well or right for the biotech sector, for the life sciences sector, for healthcare in general, and start investing massively. For instance, we have a National Institute of Virology, but why don't we have a viral repository? Why don't we have a genomic library of viruses? Why don't we have all the capabilities that a country like India should have, where it can have a rapid research response to any such outbreak? Because we haven't invested enough. The National Institute of Virology is a sort of a reactive body. It does a lot of the virology work, but I don't think they have the right equipment with which to do all of what I'm saying. So I think this is a time to relook at all these institutes we have created with the right intent, but we have not invested in them. Whether it is the National Institute of Virology, the National Institute of Immunology, we even have the TB Institute in Bangalore. It's now called the National Institute of Infectious Diseases. We have so many other of these kind of institutes, but if you actually go and visit them, you'll see that they're under-resourced and they're really not doing the kind of cutting-edge work that they ought to be doing. Yes, in Bangalore, we are very fortunate that we have the National Center of Biological Sciences, which is really doing cutting-edge research. We've got the Jawaharlal Nehru Center for Advanced Scientific Research, and we have, of course, IISc. So these are the big outstanding centers of excellence who are actually at least have got good infrastructure and they are doing cutting edge work. But we really need to direct the focus now in communicable diseases, which I think the whole world has ignored. And I think this is the time now for India to offer its partnership to some of these other countries in the West, where we can actually get them to invest and co-invest with us.
So in that sense, the way the Human Genome Project was this massive investment and this big initiative that was driven by the US, which led to a whole host of technologies and a whole host of developments, we have this opportunity within this pandemic where India can make large investments and bring together a lot of bright minds and do something that will not just help us tackle COVID-19, but perhaps ensure that something of this scale never happens again.
Absolutely. And, you know, we don't even value the kind of intellectual talent that we have in this country when it comes to science and technology. In that context, if you look at China, they have a huge capability and infrastructure and scientific research that's going on. And what I haven't discussed right now is all the work that's going on in China for vaccine development, diagnostics, and what have you. I can tell you that they'll probably beat COVID-19 faster than others, because I'm really impressed with the amount of capabilities they have in this whole area of biosciences.
Even if the virus might have started there, they might be providing us some of the solutions as well.
Yes.
But I'm really hoping that Bangalore can become a center that can stand on its own legs on par with Boston and anywhere else in the world in terms of the kind of scientific output and talent and ideas and products that are coming out that can really help not just India, but the world.
Absolutely.
Kiran, thank you so much for joining us. Would you have any final word of advice or caution to our listeners while we are still in this lockdown?
I think we must live with hope. There is a lot of promise. And I would just like to say that we don't want alarmist kind of comments. I don't want pessimism to creep in, because we must keep our hopes alive. Just sharing with you all that's happening, I feel very reassured that I think, you know, we will get over this sooner than later.
Kiran, as you rightly said, we will get more data as we do more testing. And we have seen internationally, as the tests have increased, the numbers have increased. And I think the point you're making is, while the numbers might increase with the testing, we shouldn't get alarmed and then study what's behind those numbers and have a plan to fix it. Have I got you right, Kiran?
Absolutely. We must not kid ourselves. We must expect a large number of people to be infected. So don't think that the numbers won't zoom up. But what we really need to look at and put a lot of attention to is, how severe is the disease? If the disease is not so severe, then we can actually be far more confident. From what all I've said to you, I think you can see that we are building ourselves to a zone of comfort and confidence. That's what we really need to focus on for the next 21 days.
Thank you so much, Kiran, and thank you, Pawan, for doing this first episode of BIC Talks.
Thank you for staying with us till the end. If you have any questions or comments, do write in to podcast@thinkpragati.com. And hey, if you like the podcast and listen to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review. It'll mean a lot to us. The Pragati podcast is available on the IVM podcast app and pretty much every other podcast app and platform. We are there everywhere.